What's up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricardo Varendez, also known as Ricky Varendez. And today we have a great episode for you. Author Stephen Kinzer. He's written tons of books. I've actually attempted to get him on in the past and had very little luck with getting a hold of him. And weirdly enough, some of his people contacted me and said, hey, would you like to have Stephen Kinzer on? He has a new book called Poisoner in Chief that's coming out, and would love to come on to talk about it. So it worked out. And his name's probably familiar to a lot of you guys because he's written tons of great, great books. One called Overthrow America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. He wrote the very popular The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. All the Shah's Men, Blood of Brothers, A Thousand Hills. I mean, he's written so many books, Crescent and Star, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. He's written tons of really, really amazing books. So hopefully have him on in the future to talk about some of his other books. But today he's on to talk about a topic that I haven't actually talked about on this show before, which is weird because I'm almost to my 200th episode and I haven't talked a whole lot specifically on MKUltra. So his new book is called Poisoner in Chief, like I mentioned. The subtitle is Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. So a lot of the show is based on this, mind control, MKUltra. And if you're not familiar with Sidney Gottlieb and his hand in all this, it's going to be a very, very interesting show. So I'll leave it at that. Enjoy the show. Remember, guys, I have a Patreon page. If you guys want to support the show, you can donate whatever you can afford, a dollar, a couple bucks, whatever it is. And all that money goes to helping for bandwidth, storage, all the costs that go into keeping this podcast going. Also, it gives me a little bit of extra motivation to hurry the hell up and get these shows out and get people booked when I get a little busy. I have a copy of advanced copy of his book. His book comes out on September 10th, and this show should be out roughly around that time. So probably by the time you're hearing this, the show or the book is available. So definitely check it out on Amazon, anywhere you can get books. But it's a very good book. I am a slow reader and I have limited time to read. So it took me a while to kind of get into it. And I couldn't get through all of it before the interview. But what I did read, it seems very fascinating. And I do plan on going through the rest of it eventually. So definitely, like I said, check out the book, support these authors. It's really important. So it keeps them going and they can keep putting out this great research. But back to my Patreon page, if you're a Patreon supporter, I will let you know in advance the guests that are booked, when they're booked, all that stuff way in advance. Most people, unless you're a close friend or something like that, find out about who's on the show when the shows are released. They don't know. They don't have any advanced knowledge. They don't know in advance. So if you're a Patreon supporter, that's kind of my little way of saying thank you, is I give you some behind the scene information. Also, you can support us by purchasing the music you hear. The Theory 6 Music Project is my solo project. The Ripple Effect is the song you hear at the beginning. And if you like that song, purchase it. Then money also goes to supporting the show. We have a YouTube channel, RV Theory 6. Subscribe to us, like us, review, go on iTunes, Stitch, or whatever it may be, and give us thumbs up, give us likes, give us 5 stars, however you review and rate the show. Please do that, and all that stuff helps. So that's it for now. Remember to also share the show if you can't afford to help financially. Just sharing these shows, put on your social media, do that type of stuff. It goes a long way with just spreading the word. And even if sharing the show on your social media only exposes the show to one more listener at a time, then it's worth doing. So, and it's a completely, obviously, free. It doesn't cost you anything to do, and it goes a long way. So that type of stuff, reviewing, rating, all that, you know, those little things that don't seem like a big deal, but if you go out of your way and do it, it does help spread the word. It's very much appreciated. So thanks again, guys, and I'll see you in the next one. Peace. Sidney isn't somebody that people who, even like myself, who research MK Ultra and the CIA mind control experiments or brainwashing experiments, I haven't run into his name that often. And so,
but not at all. He's a totally anonymous figure.
Sidney Gottlieb, even after I saw the title of your book, and I'm like, you know what? I'm sure I've seen this name somewhere. It sounds somewhat familiar. And I even attempted to do some research outside of your book, and I'm like, oh, let me see what there isn't. Like, it seems like you're the first person to actually take some time to look into him. Yeah.
Yeah. I am.
So how did it happen? Because you've covered, you know, the Dulles brothers and so many interesting topics in history. How do you choose, you know, the topic for your next book? And then how did you specifically decide to get involved in this one?
This is my 10th book. And I have to say that in the course of my research for other books, I found a lot of very surprising stories, including stories that shocked many readers, although they didn't shock me. But this book did. So this is the first time I've written a book that really shocked me to the point that I couldn't believe these things actually happened. I'm still recovering from the shock that went into the writing of this book. So how did I get here? How did I discover this totally anonymous figure who I believe was probably the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century, unless there was somebody else out there who was totally invisible and had a license to kill U.S. government, which Sidney Gottlieb had. Some years ago, I wrote a book that was a biography of the Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, who served during the 1950s, and his brother Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA. During that period, the CIA was involved in assassination attempts, and we made poison to kill several foreign leaders. I told that story in my book about the Dulles brothers, how there was a CIA chemistry lab, and they made poison pills for Castro and poison potions and a poison wetsuit. And I also went into the story of Patrice Lumumba, the prime minister of the Congo. Eisenhower ordered his assassination in the summer of 1960, and Alan Dulles, the CIA director, dispatched a chemist not only to make Lumumba, but then to carry it physically to the Congo to be used in killing the prime minister. Later on, I began to ask myself, what is that CIA chemistry shop? I came across a very interesting story. When the CIA was trying to kill Castro, their first idea was, as you may know, to hire the mafia because they were used to assassinating people. A CIA envoy went to meet with two big-time mafia mobsters in a hotel room in Las Vegas, and the CIA guy was told, we don't want to assassinate Castro like the things we used to do in Chicago. That's not going to work. You've been watching get away. You must have somebody that makes poisons. Why don't we do it that way? So, of course, neither of these gangsters had ever heard of Sidney Gottlieb. Neither had the guy they were talking to who was working with the CIA. But they were right. There must be some guy. So I traced this back and found out that there was a person who made the poisons that the CIA used for foreign leaders. And that's the genesis of the title of my book, Poisoner in Chief. But I soon discovered in researching Sidney Gottlieb that making poisons to kill foreign leaders was only a little bit of a side project for him. His main function was to direct a 10-year-long project, MK Ultra, that was designed to give the CIA a way to control human minds. In the course of this project, he carried out the most extreme medical experiments that have ever been sponsored by the U.S. government. He figured out that in order to find a way to implant a new mind into somebody's brain, the first thing he had to do was blow away the mind that was in there. So he spent years testing on poor unfortunates, not all of whom survived, all sorts of techniques aimed at destroying the human mind. And this increased my interest in Gottlieb. Then I later understood that he was the godfather of the LSD culture, the man who brought LSD to the United States. He also had this very interesting private life where he was a sort of a proto-hippie, lived in a house with no running water with an outdoor toilet, and he got up before dawn to milk his goats, and he meditated, and he studied Buddhism. So I realized that I have a really fascinating character who exemplifies the hidden side of the forces that shape the world. And the deeper I got into his story, not only the scarier it became, but the stranger it became to realize that a person who was this powerful, who had life or death power given by the U.S. government, was so totally unknown.
Yeah, well, the thing is about the MKUltra project, it's one of those terms or operations that people who usually are talking about it get pigeonholed into a conspiracy theorist or whatnot, and it's like, yeah, you know, but it's like when you really look into it, it's like I tell people, I'm like, there's declassified documents. There's, I mean, they've basically admitted to it. I know there's been two times it went to the Supreme Court, and you know, cases that are related to MKUltra. You know, it's like it's pretty. There's historical records. There's pretty good evidence that this stuff did happen. There's probably way more than we even know. It was all done on, you know, with taxpayers' money. That's the craziest thing, is that, you know, Midnight Climax and all these things are done with taxpayers' money, and they're just experimenting with all types of crazy stuff. And really, you know, how much of it actually worked, or how much of it actually you know, really was even used outside of just experiments.
Well, you're right. At the end of 10 years of brutalizing, in many cases, unwitting subjects, and others, people that had just been picked up in places like Europe and East Asia and were thought to be enemy agents and who were thought of as being expendable, after 10 years of destroying human lives in the search for mind control, Sidney Gottlieb, who was in the end a scientist, was forced to conclude that mind control is a myth and that the whole effort had been for nothing. It was a failure. So I asked myself, how did these CIA guys get the idea that you could program people to go out and kill or commit sabotage, or that you could have a truth serum, or that you could have an amnesiac that would make people forget everything they were and everything they'd done? Where do you get these ideas? And I think a lot of it comes from the world of fiction. I have a section in my book where I trace through the books, the short stories, the novels, the movies that these people would have been watching as they grew up and as adults. It was a favorite trope of fiction that somebody would hypnotize you, like a Svengali, or in Gaslight, they would control you, and you could find ways through hypnosis or drugs to control other people. So the CIA promoted this brainwashing fantasy, and then they fell for it themselves. So fiction actually fed into MKUltra, and then years later, in a kind of an odd closing of this circle, after Sidney Gottlieb had concluded that the whole thing was all a fake and didn't work, it was too late. The fictional world had already picked up on it. And now you can see on everything from video games to TV shows to movies, like the Spotless Mind movie or Men in Black or Bourne Identity, all kinds of references to blowing away people's minds, implanting new ideas, stealing things out of people's minds. In some cases, they actually mention MKUltra. So MKUltra, which was nourished from fantasies taken from the fictional world, actually wound up nourishing a whole generation of fiction that we're still living through.
Now, for people listening who have heard the term MKUltra but aren't familiar exactly what they were doing or how they're finding these how could you do it to humans and people that have families or friends or some type of background and not getting caught. I mean, how is this stuff happening without anybody knowing for so long? And also, what exactly, you know, what was some of the more deranged, violent, or weird things that you found that they were doing?
Well, I asked myself that question repeatedly when I was working on this book. How could Gottlieb have done all of this and gotten away with it? The CIA allowed this sociopath to carry out his wildest fantasies. He had a license to destroy minds and to destroy bodies. He himself used LSD, by his own estimate, something like 200 times. So his imagination was quite fertile. I think that the people at the CIA were captured by the Cold War mentality of that moment, which led them to think that civilization was in imminent danger, something we're now being told again. Therefore, under those conditions, everything is justified, something we're also being told again. And the loss of a few lives or even a few hundred lives would seem like something very minor compared to the possible prize out there. Alan Dulles, the CIA director, gave the project this name, MK Ultra, and he truly believed that if you could find the key to mind control, the prize would be nothing less than global mastery. It would make such other CIA projects of the early 1950s, like overthrowing the government of Iran or overthrowing the government of Guatemala, pale into insignificance. So they placed a huge importance on the project, but they didn't want to know what was going on. I think the few people like Dulles at the CIA who had an idea of what Gottlieb was doing didn't want any more than an idea. And they knew that it must have to be something awful if you're trying to find ways to destroy people's minds. Therefore, don't tell me about it. And in a sense, this allowed Gottlieb to take this project in completely bizarre directions. So what did he do? Again, you could write a whole book about it, but let me just give you a couple of examples. Gottlieb ran a project in Canada in which a doctor placed patients who had innocently come to him because they had marital problems or postpartum or relatively minor psychological problem, and then he would capture them as unwitting subjects in this MK Ultra web. And in these experiments at McGill University, people would be put into comas for periods as long as weeks at a time, kept in sensory deprivation chambers where the only outside influence would be flashing strobe lights, and they would be wired with headphones over which they would be hearing simple messages repeated tens of thousands of times over and over again, like, "My mother hates me." Then you'd be awoken, given stimulus shock, and then try to find out, do you now believe your mother hates you? Does your mind still exist? Can you function? Can you hold a fork? Can you recognize your relatives anymore? And of course, many of the people that went through this, their minds were destroyed. So that was just one example of the 149 sub-projects that Gottlieb carried out. Another one took place at a prison in Kentucky. Gottlieb liked to use prisoners for subjects because the wardens were happy to cooperate and the prisoners had no choice, effectively. So at this one prison in Kentucky, he oversaw an experiment in which seven African-American inmates were fed what were described in the memo I saw as double, triple, and quadruple doses of LSD every day for 77 days without being told what it was. So you can imagine, or maybe you can't, I know, I don't think I can, what goes on in a human mind under that kind of treatment. It was all kind of collateral damage for Gottlieb to try to find out if, as in this case, would a massive dose of LSD destroy someone's mind? Or would sensory deprivation and these other kinds of techniques that he was testing in Canada have the same result? The other piece of this was what Gottlieb carried out in other parts of the world. He had safe houses in Europe and in East Asia where he conducted experiments, sometimes lethal, on people that were arrested by the CIA as suspected enemy agents or refugees who just turned up and didn't seem to have anybody behind them or knew anyone, so they could be considered expendables. I went out to visit the first CIA safe house where these torture experiments were carried out. And it's in Germany. The guy who now owns the house, he just bought it a few years ago and has turned it into a nice place where you can have apartments, showed me around. He even took me down into the storage rooms in the basement, which were the cells where these experiments took place. And he said, in this house, the CIA brought Nazi doctors who had worked in the concentration camps, and together they designed and carried out experiments like the ones that were carried out in the concentration camps. They were just using Nazi doctors to begin a program of experiments that would continue what the Nazis and their Japanese counterparts began. And this guy who owns this former torture house told me, people in the neighborhood have come up to me and they all say they know exactly what went on here. And they tell me that bodies of the victims were buried in the forest around here in places where there are now apartment buildings and shopping malls. So Gottlieb was traveling around the world carrying out these horrific and in some cases deadly experiments in the pursuit of what he later realized was a fantasy, mind control, without any effective control or supervision. It was partly intentional as a way to be able to say later, the CIA didn't have any institutional responsibility, nor did the U.S. government. It was all Sidney's fault. We had one guy who got a little out of control. And allowing him to act completely on his own made it possible for the CIA later to explain his actions in this way.
Yeah, that's wild. And You grew up in the 60s and 70s. Did you ever experiment with psychedelics? And I'm assuming after writing this book, you probably never want to.
Well, I can tell you that sitting at home with your friends and the music playing and taking a tab of LSD is not any way to appreciate the torture that LSD was used to inflict on people in the Gottlieb experiments. Now, another very interesting part of his life was that in addition to all these coercive, Gottlieb also oversaw experiments in which volunteers were asked to come in and they were told they would be given a psychoactive substance. So this would be an experiment that took place in a hospital in the United States or in a clinic or in a university. And these kids would sometimes be paid money for their time, just like you are in any other kind of medical experiment. So Gottlieb bought the entire world supply of LSD, convincing the CIA to spend $240,000 to do this. And when he brought it to the United States, he used a couple of bogus foundations that he informed the medical community. We're now ready to pay for and sponsor experiments aimed at testing this new drug, LSD, and we will also supply you with the LSD. So many hospitals and universities replied. I mean, it was a great project. They're providing the money, and you get the LSD. So they then advertised for people to come in and try the substance, be a research subject. That's the way that LSD leaked out of the CIA into the counterculture. California, some of the first people that signed up to take these experiments, to use LSD under the auspices of what they thought was a hospital but was really the CIA, were, for example, Ken Kesey, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Where did he first try LSD? He got it from Sidney Gottlieb, although he didn't know that at the time. Same thing for Allen Ginsberg, the poet. He took his first LSD at Stanford University at an experiment. That LSD came from MKUltra, from the CIA, from Sidney Gottlieb. Robert Hunter, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, brought the Grateful Dead their first LSD. He got it from Sidney Gottlieb. He was another subject in the experiments at Stanford. So through these experiments, LSD leaked into the counterculture. This makes Sidney Gottlieb an unwilling godfather of the entire 60s counterculture, which is a tremendous irony because it meant that the drug that Gottlieb and the CIA hoped would give them the key to controlling humanity actually wound up fueling a generational rebellion that was aimed at destroying everything that the CIA defended and held dear.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who believe, and apparently, you know, obviously you're stating it now, the links between the CIA, the government, and the hippie movement and the LSD movement and the counterculture. And a lot of people, and I've heard people debate this about if it was purposely put out there and pushed to the public for the purpose of dumbing down the public or whatnot. In a way, I almost feel like if that was true, if that was their intentions, it almost became counterproductive because a lot of those hippies were also the anti-war movement. And I almost feel like, you know, it's weird because using something like LSD and psychedelics for brainwashing, a lot of times, you know, some people believe that you can use, like you said, if you're sitting around listening to music, it can help you look at things from different perspectives and help you be artistic. And I think it was a Bill Hicks joke where it's like, you know, if you don't think drugs have done any good in the world, you know, go home and burn all your albums because they're all really messed up, you know. And there's a lot of truth to that. So do you see any evidence that possibly it was purposely pushed onto the public for the purpose of maybe dumbing down the public, or, you know, if it was used, I guess, for a lack of a better word, like a weapon in that sense?
I don't see intentionality in that way. I do think that LSD was used in experiments for reasons beyond the stated reasons. The real reason was to find ways to control people. But I don't believe that anybody at the CIA, which would have been Gottlieb, since he was really the only person doing this, actually imagined that LSD would leak out and it would become a recreational drug. But when the leading figures of that era looked back on it, they all concluded this. Allen Ginsberg later realized it. So did Ken Kesey, and so did the Grateful Dead. I found an interview with John Lennon in which he was asked about LSD, and he said, "We must always remember to thank the CIA." He didn't say, "Thank Sidney Gottlieb," but he would have if he had known that Gottlieb existed. Even Timothy Leary came to psychedelics through Sidney Gottlieb, although, like all these other people I've mentioned, he didn't realize it at the time. Tim Leary's interest in psychedelics was first sparked by an article that he read in Life magazine in 1957 about a couple of went to Mexico, and there they found the magic mushroom, which has these psilocybin effects of on the mind. So Tim Leary read this. He was fascinated. He later went to Mexico. He found the mushrooms. He used them. He said it was the greatest experience of his life. And that led him on to the whole LSD prophet identity that he later assumed. Now, he didn't know it, but that expedition that produced the Life magazine article was actually sponsored by Sidney Gottlieb and MK Ultra and the CIA. Because not only for established drugs like mescaline and heroin and cocaine and LSD as possible means of mind control, he was also looking at animal poisons and barks and plants and mushrooms. So this mushroom project was just one of his 149 sub-projects. That's the one that electrified Tim Leary. And Leary himself later said the whole LSD movement was started by the CIA. So I don't think that they started it out intentionally as a way to spread it through a new generation. And actually, the fact that that happened wound up creating the biggest challenge that the CIA has ever had to face, and one that it's never really managed to overcome.
Yeah, it's weird that they were kind of, because a lot of these quotes and a lot of these things people said that link LSD to the CIA, a lot of it is what they use in arguments and saying that, hey, this was a and usually it's anti-LSD, anti-psychedelic type of people who say, hey, you know, it was a CIA trap to try to get people to dumb down America and blah, blah, blah. But I, a lot of times, I mean, this stuff is used to be artistic. It's used to be creative, to look at things outside the box. I've had Dennis McKenna on, who's the brother of Terrence McKenna. And, you know, he's a big advocate of using it as plant medicines and all the, you know, he has I forget what the organization is called, a Hefter organization or Hefter Institute, similar to MAPS, and it looks into using MDMA and all these things for as medicines and the possible benefits of them. So it is weird how, you know, you can take one thing and you can use it to, like you said, to ruin lives and torture people. And you can also use the same thing to expand your mind, be creative, possibly use it for you know, to heal people in some cases. So it's but it's all the same substance. So it's you know, I find that fascinating.
The inventor of LSD, the discoverer, Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist, imagined that it could be used for treating mental illness. He never imagined it as a weapon of covert action. It took Gottlieb to see that LSD could be the key to what, as one of his associates put it, the key to unlocking the universe. He developed this fantasy that it could be a weapon, something that it never was originally intended to be, and that the original discoverer was horrified to discover. So I think it's true that LSD has had a really kind of perverted career. You remember that Nixon described Timothy Leary as the most dangerous man in America, and LSD was demonized as something horrific, the worst thing that could happen to you. And I think now I think you're starting to see a new wave of rediscovery of what psychedelic drugs can do. As you said, there have been some books lately on its healing potential. Microdosing is all the rage in California. There's even going to be a musical on Broadway this spring about the use of LSD by Cary Grant and other people who actually go back to the Sidney Gottlieb era. So there's now a reassessment of this drug, but it's amazing to me that although Gottlieb himself used it many times and must have seen its spiritual side because he meditated so much, he also saw it principally as a weapon of war, of covert action, and that really perverted what the discoverers had hoped LSD might be able to do positively in the world.
Now, have you ever looked into the Whitey Bulger link to the MKUltra project or the Unabomber link? Because they both have, you know, links to the MKUltra project and possibly some of their craziness could be because they were a part of, you know, some of these LSD CIA experiments.
So those are interesting questions.
Oh, lost it for a second.
In my book and in all my books, I only deal with facts. Everything has a footnote. Everything comes from a source. So I try to leave the speculation and the conclusions to the reader. I like readers to be able to participate in the adventure of discovery that I'm going through as I'm writing the book. So to answer your questions, yes and no. So I don't include the story about Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, although he was involved in drug experiments at Harvard. And Harvard was one of the places that were MK Ultra hired students to as subjects. And Kaczynski's mind may well have been distorted by the horrors that he had to go through in some of these experiments at Harvard. I wasn't able to tie them directly to MK Ultra, so I don't have him in there. But Whitey Bulger is another story. I was able to document specifically that Whitey Bulger, while he was an inmate at the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, was the subject of an experiment carried out by one of Gottlieb's most important collaborators, a doctor named Pfeiffer, who told Whitey Bulger and a number of other prisoners at this institution that he was researching a possible cure for schizophrenia, and he wanted to test this medicine on them. So Whitey Bulger was fed LSD after agreeing to take it as part of this experiment every day for over a year. He later wrote a notebook about it, the horrible experiences he had. He said, I felt I was going insane. I didn't want to tell anybody about seeing the clocks jumping around on the wall and the patterns that I saw, because I thought they would declare me crazy and I'd never see the outside world again. He wrote, I was in for committing a crime, but I think they committed a greater crime on me. And in the 70s, so decades later, when the phrase MK Ultra first became public and it became clear that this experiment in Atlanta was part of MK Ultra, Whitey Bulger told his associates, I'm going to find Pfeiffer, that doctor, and I'm going to kill him because of what he did for me. Now, he never managed to do that, and Pfeiffer died a natural death. But undoubtedly, if Whitey Bulger had known that above Pfeiffer there was somebody else, and it was Sidney Gottlieb, he certainly would have turned his ire on Gottlieb, and history might have turned out a little differently for Gottlieb.
Now, I know you. We talked about a little bit about how they kind of failed. I mean, they were trying to figure out ways to interrogate people. They're using a lot of these experiments for all, you know, trying to brainwash people, mind control, and how a lot of this stuff failed and really didn't, they didn't come to any real conclusion that this worked or that worked or whatnot. But obviously, you know, the case of Sirhan Sirhan, a lot of people think that, hey, this guy, you know, a kind of a explanation to what happened could be that he was brainwashed and that, you know, that's why he doesn't remember what happened and whatnot. What's your opinions on that? Do you think there's any link to that, or do you think that there's no real evidence?
Well, there's no real evidence, that's for sure. But it's an intriguing case, there are a lot of very curious elements to it. Unfortunately, as I said, in my books, I don't deal with intriguing cases and possibilities. I'm glad other authors do. But I didn't want to put the Sirhan case in because I only write about what's a known fact. So I steered clear of that one. I'm curious about it myself. I did a lot of reading before I decided not to include it. But one of the things that the Gottlieb story makes you realize is how much is going on behind the facade of public politics and public diplomacy that we see. And it has to make you wonder to what extent the covert sphere really shapes lives around us. Because if Gottlieb could get away with doing all of this for so long with government permission, are there other amazingly bloody projects now unfolding that some other writer like me in a generation or two is going to find out about? It can't help but lead you into this realm. And I think one of the things I had to watch for when I was researching this book is getting seduced too far away from what's factually provable, which is overwhelming enough, and leaking into the area of speculation, which is something that I'm glad other people do, but I don't do.
Yeah. I hear you. I mean, it is nice to have somebody like yourself who focuses on what can be provable, and it kind of prevents the issue that a lot of us run into, and that's, you know, you say anything that seems a little hard to believe, or you talk about any historical events that seem hard to believe, and people immediately use the term, you know, conspiracy theory, or you know, or they, like I said, they pigeonhole you in that. And when you get authors like yourself that really focus on, like, you don't need to make things up, you don't need to come up with spectacular stories and connect dots that are really far from one another to come up with these incredible theories. I mean, there's enough real evidence out there and declassified information. And I know that years ago, I don't know if it's still on YouTube because there's so much restriction on what's on YouTube or not anymore. But I remember one time seeing, like, even a testimony from somebody who's a part of some CIA experiment on YouTube, and a woman explaining what she dealt with and talking about shock therapy sexual things that happen or whatnot. And it's like, there's so much real evidence out there that you don't really need to, I guess, like you said, focus on speculation and, you know, the stuff that you really can't prove. But I think when a book like yours comes out and you see how much of this stuff is true and how much crazy stuff did happen, it makes the stuff that we speculate about seem much more believable.
Absolutely. It's a product of immersing yourself in the truth that you begin to wonder what else is out there. In my book, the chapter I'm always the most proud of is the footnotes. So there's dozens of pages of footnotes. Practically every sentence or every paragraph has a footnote. So everything comes from somewhere. Section of my book, though, I started out with a sentence that might be my favorite sentence in the book. I write, everything in this book is true, but not everything that's true is in this book. So I don't have the slightest doubt that I have uncovered only a small fraction. So he destroyed all the MK Ultra records with the permission of his boss, the CIA director, Richard Helms, as he was leaving office. We've been able to piece together a certain amount of it, but most of it is never going to be known. It does have the effect that you mentioned. And I would say there is a danger, inevitably, in being a conspiracy theorist. There's also, however, the equivalent danger of being a non-conspiracy theorist, someone who believes that everything is what it seems to be. Each person has to wind their way between that Scylla and Charybdis and try to figure out how far you want to believe and how many conspiracy theories are really true. At least some are, but how many of them and which ones? That's something that each of us wrestles with in this era when the covert sphere is such a big part of modern life.
And I believe you talk about Frank Olson in your book, correct?
I certainly do. Frank Olson was the person remaining MK Ultra mystery. So he was one of Gottlieb's close collaborators, one of the people that created the poisons that were then administered to people in these safe houses in Europe. He traveled to Europe and watched people being tortured to death with poisons that he had put together. And this began to bother him. And he spoke about this to several people. He even told one of his friends that he wanted to quit the CIA. And he asked that guy, do you know a good journalist? Sometime after this, Frank Olson went out a hotel window in New York City and plunged to his death. That case was quickly ruled a suicide, but later developments have suggested that this guy did know the deepest secrets of the Cold War, and the revelation of those secrets would have been disastrous for the CIA and for the United States. Since MK Ultra was based on the premise that human life was expendable in the great cause we were engaged in, maybe the life of one person inside the project, a government scientist working for the CIA, would also be considered a reasonable price to pay. So that case is actually still alive. As we're speaking, the New York City medical examiner is considering whether to reclassify the case from cause unknown to homicide. If that happens, that will start unspooling another piece of the Gottlieb mystery. So the Frank Olson case is a great example of how the MK Ultra labyrinth was and still is.
Yeah, and I know it's gotten some attention recently because of the Netflix series Wormwood, which talks about it, focuses on Frank Olson, and yeah, it's a crazy story. That was a name that popped up a lot, you know, if you do run into MK Ultra and that type of stuff. But it's amazing the people in history like Sidney Gottlieb and you know, people like Edward Bernays and people who have like such crazy influence on what goes on in the world and the world that we live in today, and yet, you know, they've kind of, you know, there's just a lack of people talking about it. I mean, do you think when you were researching Sidney Gottlieb, do you think it was just a character people haven't run into, or do you think sometimes that there's there's some, you know, somebody making, I should say somebody, but if there's maybe a conscious attempt to maybe erase certain characters from the history books and making sure that they kind of stay unknown, you know, for the purpose of maybe making sure that some of the things that are linked to also stay unknown.
I think you're right. In Gottlieb's case, however, there wasn't the necessity to erase him from history because he never was in history. And while he was working, he didn't exist. He was officially just an invisibility. And actually, I think that when you look at what happened in the CIA later on as they tried to explain MKUltra, there was not a desire to hide what... Well, most of it will never be known, as I said, because of the destruction of records. And on the contrary, I think that there developed a certain mindset when this information started to leak out at the CIA should be described as something that was all Sidney's fault. We had one crazy guy, you know, now we realize that he was not supervised and maybe shouldn't have been in that job. And as one CIA officer later put it, some of our people were out of control in those days. So this is a way of avoiding the institutional responsibility of the CIA and of the U.S. government. It's a way to say, oh, there was one guy. Yeah. So actually, I don't think they're devoted to suppressing the story of Sidney Gottlieb. In a way, it helps them because it gives them a way to pin it all on one person who's no longer around and thereby avoid deeper questions about how this was allowed to happen and what the institutional structure was that supported it.
Yeah, I mean, this was such a crazy time in history. When you look at all the weird assassinations, you know, I've done many podcasts on the JFK assassination. I've had James DiEugenio on multiple times to talk about the RFK assassination and the MLK assassination. I mean, there's just so much. And then you look at all the coups, all the stuff that was going on. I mean, and, you know, that's probably one of the reasons why you wrote the book about the Dulles brothers, because, you know, they were so influential in this time in American history also. And I mean, it just seems like there's so much going on at that time. But we talk about all these things that happened, you know, like the MKUltra project, you know, a lot of the books that you've you know, written, the historical events you've written about and the historical characters you've written about. But we always talk about these things like it's past tense. Do you think any of this stuff is continuing, or there's something similar to it? Or do you think that similar to MKUltra, similar to, you know, the coups that the documents that become declassified and we find out about the assassination attempts and the coups and all this stuff, do you think that stuff is going, because some of it, I mean, obviously some of it's documented now. You see what's going on in Venezuela, you see you know, what we're trying to do in Syria, our drone attacks in Yemen. I mean, some of this stuff is documented, but it always makes me wonder, like, how much don't we know? Like, how much is going on behind the scenes that we're not going to find out for another 20, 50, 100 years? Do you kind of look at the history in a similar light?
That's a question that naturally comes up when you're researching bizarre events of the past. But I actually think that the real problem we face in understanding the world isn't that so much is hidden. It's that we don't even pay attention to what's available to us. We're so caught up in certain stereotypes about what's Russia, what's Iran, what's Syria, what's Venezuela, that we don't step outside and examine evidence that might give a different view from what we're constantly hearing from Washington. So the first step before we start trying to figure out things that are happening underneath the surface is to look at the reality of what's happening in the world that contradicts the official narrative that you're getting from the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the press and the think tank establishment in Washington. It's so hard to crack that blob, but information is out there. If you want to find out what's really happening in Syria as opposed to what we say or what's really happening in Iran, you can. You can't find out everything, but you can find out a lot more than you already know. And so my advice is don't give up on the idea of believing that there are hidden forces shaping our society. But don't be frustrated and think since you can't find out about that, you don't know about the world. There's actually a lot out there that will help us see the world in a clearer way than the way we're being told to see it if we only take the time to jump outside the official narrative and try to understand more deeply what's going on in the world from sources that are available to us if we want to use them.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, one of the problems with that is I'm sure you do a lot of your research online, just like myself. And do you see the issue with just you Google something or you're looking up something and you're getting one narrative, you're getting mainstream media's perspective, you're getting, you know, the whatever the mainstream newspaper or website is, you're getting their articles first, and you're starting to see more and more of that, and you're and it's getting harder to run into independent researchers or smaller, not so popular authors or websites or whatnot. And I think then it's becoming harder. Like before, I think it was the issue of, yeah, there's a lot of people that just believe ignorance is bliss. They can go on with their lives and you know, they almost don't want to do the research or learn what's really going on because it's depressing, let's be honest. And maybe it's easier to just ignore it and move on with your life. And I also think there's the issue with people who are just so busy. I mean, I think you're an East Coaster, right? You do you live in Boston or in the East
Coast? I do,
yeah. Yeah, and I live in Ludlow, Massachusetts, which is near Springfield, Massachusetts, Western Mass. And, you know, as you know, us East Coasters, we live very fast-paced lives. I mean, everybody's always on the go, gotta go pick up the kids, gotta go to the gym, gotta go, you know, grab food somewhere, grocery store. And a lot of people just don't have time to sit down and really learn what's going on. And that was problem one. Now we're running into a much bigger problem that even if you do find the time, if you make a conscious effort to attempt to learn about what's going on in the world around you, now you can barely do that without being force-fed a narrative and agenda. And when you're doing research, have you seen throughout the years of researching for your books or any topics that you might be intrigued with, have you found that it's getting harder to find maybe opinions or perspectives outside of the mainstream narrative?
The narrative of American innocence and American good intentions and benign action in the world is very powerful. It cuts across ideological lines. You will see all the coverage on Fox News and on CNN and on MSNBC essentially promoting the same narrative. The differences among them are quite small. So you see this unanimity, for example, you're seeing on all these channels that Vladimir Putin is an evil tyrant and he murders people all the time and he's ambitious to take over the whole world. And it's on all the stations and it's in every newspaper and it's what every prominent political leader is telling you. Add that to what we were told about Iran, what we're told about Syria, and so on. It just seems strange that why would you want to go outside that since it seems to be unanimous. So my great desire for myself and my recommendation for others is always question the official narrative. Don't be caught up in that. Power has so many ways to promote its perception of the world. Don't buy into that. Step aside and try to take your own approach. It's true that it becomes more difficult as time goes by because of this unanimity that you're seeing in the press. And frankly, I understand why the political parties and the think tanks in Washington and Congress and presidents all buy into this narrative. I see the political and economic reasons behind it. But as a former journalist or a recovering journalist, I'm particularly outraged at the role of the press. The press really sees itself as part of the game. We're like a team. America's a team, and the press has a role, like every person on a team has a role. I hate this. I don't think the press should be on anybody's team. We're not supposed to be promoting narratives. We're supposed to be questioning narratives. But in fact, all the press is doing in almost all cases is serving as just a sounding board for the Washington echo chamber. It just repeats mindlessly what people in Washington say, often people who know nothing about situations in the world and are just parroting material that promotes their own political perspective. So the press has played a really shameful role in dumbing down America and in making us see the world in very distorted ways. It's part of my project to try to undermine that. I write a column on world affairs for the Boston Globe, and when I don't have something to write about, I always ask myself, what's something that everybody believes? Maybe I can write a column saying that that's not true. That's why I've written columns saying I'm against human rights, I'm against the United Nations, I'm against veterans, I'm in favor of dictators. I always like to contradict the narrative and be somewhat provocative and try to let people think in a new way. So I'm always urging people to liberate yourself from the tyranny of what you're getting from the press, which is really one voice, and try to see the world in a clearer way.
Yeah, it's so true, because you know, when you hear something enough times, it becomes true. And they did it when something you've researched and written a lot about, you know, the what happened in Guatemala, Nicaragua, you know, all the coups in American history. And you know, a lot of times it was justified because it was communism, or it was, you know, because of socialism or whatever the ism they want to use. And even these words are just words that they repeat over and over again and keep telling you it's bad. And most people don't even know what it means. You know, they're not even
sure.
Well,
it does tie back to the Gottlieb era in one very important sense. John Foster Dulles said in the 1950s that civilization only faces a crisis like this every 1,000 years. And it wasn't since the time that the Muslims invaded Europe in the 14th century that civilization had faced a challenge like communism. Once you believe that, everything to defend yourself is justified. Now, we're hearing a version of the same thing. You just replace communism with terrorism. And we're also told again, our civilization is in terrible danger. We're a little poor United States surrounded by these horrible enemies that are coming after us on all sides. We have to have forward defense and fight wars around the world in order to save ourselves. This was exactly the mindset that led the Dulles brothers to go out and overthrow governments. So every generation comes up with their own version of this idea. We would never do this under normal circumstances, but these circumstances are almost unique in human history. And we're getting that again with the terrorism narrative. So these depressing cycles do tend to repeat themselves.
Now, I'm not sure we kind of talked about a couple of different things, but the one question that I'm not sure I got an answer for, and I was curious on, was that have you seen a change in when doing research, if you are doing it online, in the type of stuff that you're seeing first? That, you know, because we're obviously the last 6 months, you know, couple months to a year, we're seeing a lot of conversation about how Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and all these platforms are suppressing certain people. And I know guests have been on my show that their documentaries or their websites or their films or research websites have been suppressed and don't come up, you know, immediately on the first page, even if you put in the exact title to the article or the exact title to the documentary. Have you seen a change in what your search results have been, or has it not really affected you?
It's hard to be certain, but it's definitely true that the unanimity to which I just referred, that you find in the press on dealing with world affairs, does lead to the fact that all the stories you're going to see on the first few Google pages are all reinforcing the same approach. Now, I do see the social media outlets succumbing to pressure from government to block certain people and promote certain others. I recently read that Twitter will no longer take accounts from official government news sources. So anything that's coming from directly from a government or from somebody who works for a government news agency, that won't be accepted on Twitter anymore. So if you're working for, let's say, the official government information agency of Russia, you cannot post on Twitter anymore. But I ask myself, they're still posting what comes on CNN and what comes on Fox News and in the New York Times. Most of that stuff is also promoting an official narrative. Yeah, it's not really an arm of the U.S. government in the sense that they're sponsoring it, but the effect is the same. So actually, with the guise of this one little tool banning official news agencies from Twitter, you're actually further skewing the narrative by cutting out of the conversation voices that would tend to challenge our established American view of the world.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, I mean, I think just my guest yesterday was telling me about how Daniel McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute got banned for you know, some sarcastic tweet or whatnot. And it's funny how they pick and choose, you know, what things to ban and whatnot. And I mean, I'm like you. I'm one of those believers that, you know, you should look at people from completely different perspectives and really, you know, ask yourself, like, why am I being fed this narrative? Let me look at the alternative perspective. Let me assume that this is untrue for the purpose of kind of figuring, seeing all sides to the story. So I think when people, when there's one greater power who's deciding what truth is or what facts are, then I think that becomes a huge issue. So you know, thank God that there's authors like yourself and researchers like yourself who are pushing back against that.
Well, I'm going to keep beating my spoon on the high chair, and I really appreciate you giving me the chance to do that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And so your book will be out the 10th, right? September 10th?
I believe that's the date, yeah.
That's the date, and it'll be available on Amazon, your website, everywhere you can get books up.
And you're, what do I say, your local independent bookseller.
Yeah. And so great. Thanks, Stephen. I really, really appreciate your time. Keep up the great work and hopefully have you on in the future because I'm sure you'll be writing more books.
Okay, I'll look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Hey, take care. Bye.
I believe in the ripple effect.